Welcome to the Wrath of the Iotians podcast. Two Gen X friends discuss fantasy, horror, and science fiction books and topics. This is episode 43, an interview with Juliet Wade, author of the Broken Trust series. I'm Jake in Boston, taking the MC spot for a change. As always, Ron is holding the fort in Seattle. Juliet Wade is a novelist, and after listening to this interview, you'll understand why it's a hard-earned and well-deserved title for this masterclass world builder. Her background is impressive. She is fluent in French and Japanese, has degrees in linguistics and anthropology, and also boasts a PhD in education. Juliet started writing fiction in 1999, and her short stories have been featured in Analog, Clark's World, and fantasy and science fiction magazines. But she is perhaps best known for her projected five-volume Broken Trust series, whose latest volume, Inheritors of Power, was published earlier this year by Daw. Juliet's specialty is sociological science fiction, of which Broken Trust is one of our finest contemporary examples. Each stratum of Broken Trust's complex caste system has its own vocation, ideals, manners, and culture. And naturally, they come into devastating conflict. There's a lot to discuss, so let's dive in.
Juliet, my understanding is you live in the Bay Area. I lived there for a few years myself. What part of the Bay Area do you live in?
So I actually just moved away from New York.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I still own my home there, and I lived there for 27 years in the East Bay in a little town that most people don't know where it is. Yeah. It's called Newark. Everybody hears that and thinks New Jersey, but anyway, lovely little town. But actually right now I'm in Melbourne, Australia.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Just moved here to be closer to my husband's family.
Great. That's wonderful.
Which is why it's 7 a.m.
We hope you're enjoying the move so far.
I feel like we're just about on the other side of it. If I can get my cat's health to even out, then I will feel like we've really arrived.
We're happy to hear that you're settling in. I first saw you at the Emerald City Comic-Con worldbuilding panel with Kat Rambo, J.S. Dewis, and John Scalzi. And we've had Jenny on our podcast a few times, and I was excited to interview her in person. And I was struck by how generous the entire panel was during the Q&A session with the up-and-coming writers. I wanted to interview you afterwards, but your autograph line was so busy. And so I did some research later and saw you had an extensive world-building resource online, which I've never seen any other author do. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Sure. So I run a show called Dive Into Worldbuilding. And I've actually been running it since 2008, if you can believe that, before it was even possible to... It was right after Google Plus made the online chats possible and before we were actually able to record them. And I was just getting together with some friends and talking about world building. And my focus in world building is really on deep dives, taking a look at very specific detailed things in depth for an hour. And because I just moved, the show is on hiatus for the moment, but we're planning to bring it back. And I also do interviews with authors to talk about aspects of their world building. But so sometimes a topic like gender in world building, or sometimes we'll do a topic like washing clothes in world. There's a very wide range from things that are very specific, kitchens or cooking, because I actually have a great interest in just daily life practices in world building. And I think that's an aspect of world building that sometimes gets neglected. Yeah. So I have a huge archive at this point.
Yes, it is an incredible resource. And I think anyone who's trying to get into world building and understanding it, that should be the first place they go.
There are a lot of really interesting people on the YouTube channel, and I have quite a lot written summaries at the blog Dive Into World Building. I ran out of personal bandwidth to be able to continue writing the summaries, which I feel bad about because they were always to increase accessibility. But hopefully, as we resume the show, we can start having those again.
Yes.
I think it's important. Some people can't sit down and listen to an hour-long discussion.
Yes, it's true. Your YouTube channel is just a terrific resource. Anyone who's a new up-and-coming writer, definitely check out Juliet's world-building site.
I feel like there's a kind of a renaissance of science fiction relative to the cultural aspects of world-building, and it's pretty exciting. But there was a time when, and I know you've commented on this because I've seen some of the comments, when the sociological science fiction was defined as soft science fiction in some quarters, and in some quarters even with some condescension. By that, I think they mean soft science fiction, like privileging politics or philosophy, psychology, culture, over exposition of like extrapolated natural science. There are some great writers in this sort of species of science fiction, going back Alfred Bester, Harlan Ellison, Ursula Le Guin, Margaret Atwood, Brian Aldiss, Connie Willis. I could go on and on, Octavia Butler. Now you have Katie Martin and Jeff Vandermeer and Ada Palmer and you, among others. And you're writing this sociological science fiction at great acclaim. So I know you've written about the subject before, and as a linguist and an anthropologist, you probably have some insight that's worth sharing with our listeners. Do these distinctions really matter anymore? Or have they all ever mattered, really?
I think that there has been a degree of expectation. There was a sort of culture gets set up by repetition and discourse. And back in what people refer to as the golden age of science fiction, there was a lot of exploration of some of the really nuts and bolts of like stuff people hadn't grappled with before. Like a lot of the science stuff was like, oh man, we haven't been to space. We haven't done it. Now we've done that stuff. And also the discipline has matured. I think gatekeeping comes into it because I think once people are accustomed to a certain kind of pattern, then there are people who have a hard time thinking about expanding that. But at the same time, that is expanding enormously right now. I'm super excited about all of the diversification that we're seeing in science fiction and fantasy right now. Just a lot of viewpoints that we haven't seen before, or perhaps not haven't seen before, but viewpoints that haven't been examined so closely before. And I really love to see all of the acclaim that authors like N.K. Jemisin and, oh my gosh, R.B. Lemberg and other folks are getting right now. So that really is great for me. So my exposure to science fiction, I didn't come up through science fiction originally. I was coming out of academia. So I came sideways into the community and I heard a lot of the discourse about hard versus soft science fiction as I was coming up. So I was concerned about it. And then at one point, I had somebody suggest that I submit to Analog. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh my goodness, really? Because I don't think I write hard science fiction. And this was Sheila Finch, who was a really wonderful author. And she said, Stanley Schmidt is interested in all kinds of science. And I think, in fact, that if you really look into it, you'll find that social science is science in a very meticulous way, even though the things that it's trying to pin down are perhaps more chaotic.
Mm-hmm. Right. If you ever look like morphology or cognitive semiotics, like how could you say that's not a hard science?
And
it's completely impossible to understand.
Theoretical linguistics. So I was like, this is like math, you guys.
Yeah.
What the heck? But anyway, so that was how I ended up submitting for the first time to Analog. And that was how I made my first sale as an author of a short. So at that point, I realized that, in fact, Stanley Schmidt himself was super interested in the social sciences. Mm-hmm. And that made sense to me. I think one of the things that about social science is that it's always relevant because people are always present in these stories. These are human stories. Even when the characters are aliens, we're writing about human problems. And yes, there's value in making an alien that's very alien. But at the same time, you have to write a story that a human's going to care about. And you can't forget the audience. This is why we don't all write stories in alien languages, because nobody would be able to read them.
This sort of dovetails with my next question again. But so your books are not easy. They're not easy reads. You have to be paying attention. Ron and I had touched on this with Sylvain Nouvel, right? Who writes dialogue with no attribution or quotes. So you have to really be like paying attention and reading closely. In fact, at some point, I'm going to ask you a question about something that shows up once in the three books that led me to think maybe there's something else going on here, but it might be a spoiler. I don't know. But
I guess we'll see.
I'll ask it and then you could say, I don't know what you're talking about. In a similar way, like your novels really do demand the reader's attention. Like you blink and you could miss something. So what obligations, if any, do you think you have to your reader? Do you have an audience in mind when you write?
Well, it's really interesting. This is a really interesting question. I find the question of audience really fascinating. I've done some study of reading, the science of the process of reading. And one of the things that I learned was that a great portion of what we get out of a text is actually in our own minds. Mm. So that's why different people's interpretations differ, right? Because communication is not a process of transmission as though I can take a meaning and stick it in your head. Mm-hmm. It's a process of evocation where I hope that the words that I am saying to you, and I hope that you have a similar context background that will allow you to interpret their meaning in a way that is similar to the way that I interpret them.
This is like reader response theory in literary criticism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Same idea.
So it's the most common metaphor for communication is this conduit metaphor. And it really does a disservice to the process of reading and spoken communication because it implies that something is possible but it's not possible, that there is actually such a thing as a meaning, as though it were an object that I could just hand to you. So I'm very aware of that as I'm writing. I think what I try to do is I try to make a story that is readable and that people can comprehend on different levels. There is an aspect of there's plot, there are these characters, they're interacting, etc. And then there is the aspect of extra meaning. And this is just a linguistics thing where, for example, if I say that somebody stopped doing something, I'm not saying that they did it, but I'm implying that they did it because they can't stop doing something without having done it previously. Mm-hmm. This is a little bit like the lawyerly trick of saying, oh, have you stopped debating your wife? That kind of trying to trap somebody into an admission by answering a question that presupposes a particular premise. So I'm very aware as I'm writing of the kinds of social messages that come through the way that people talk. And I did a lot of research on this in my PhD, actually, where I would record people talking and transcribe it all and then analyze it in detail. And it's incredibly tedious and also incredibly interesting. And it definitely has informed a lot of how I write dialogue and how I think about the way that people think and the way that characters think, because they aren't going to think the way that we would think because their background is completely different. And I try to be true to the society that I've created in the way that people behave, in the way that people think, in the kinds of expectations they hold for their interactions. And so I guess what I'm getting around to is, yes, there are lots of extra layers here, but I don't think it means that you can't enjoy the book. It just means that there's more for you if you are paying closer attention. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of different responses to the book, and some of people are engaging with quicker read and a little bit less attention and they still enjoy it, or they don't, whatever. But I find it interesting. I can't count on everybody to notice everything, but I feel like there's a sort of truth in trying to represent all of those things well and offer those kinds of insights to a close reader.
Juliet, Verin is a secondary world with a subterranean civilization with a caste-based culture. Can you tell us a bit more about the setting of Broken Trust, and especially where we are at the opening of the Inheritors of Power?
Sure. I call it Verin, but you don't have to. Just a little tip for readers. You can call people whatever you want to. However it works in your brain is fine with me. There is an official pronunciation for the various things, but if you don't want to use that, I am totally cool with it. So I started creating the world of Varen back when I was about 13 years old, and I have worked on it on and off basically since then. So it's a lifelong project, basically. There are 8, they're all underground cities in cave systems at various points in a large continent, and they are quite different from one another, the different cities. And I have based the construction of the cities on different cave systems throughout our world. I used the city of Derinkuyu for the city of Derinbel, for example. Derinkuyu is in Turkey, I believe. And then there is a cave system called the Skokjan Caves in Slovenia, which I used as the basis for Salimna. Anyway, people live underground because the surface is an inimical wilderness. And there are floating sparks up there who will come after you and give you trouble if you try to construct things, grow food, that sort of. Growing food is actually a very large endeavor, and that is what the army is for. It is not for fighting people. It's for fighting wisps, which are the names of the little sparks on the surface. And then in the cities, there is a caste system, which has 7 levels. And it's a caste system that I built myself. It is The basis for it is I basically started with the Edo era Japanese caste system, which I have some familiarity with because of my studies of Japanese. And then from there, I looked at what the different groups did and what their functions were within the society. And then I've expanded on it and altered it a bit and took it in a different direction. But what I wanted to capture there was how we create distinctions between people and how those distinctions become so woven into our identity that we start seeing people as foreign when they are not sharing our ostensible purpose. Each caste has its own culture. It has its own values. It has its own aspirations. The things that you can achieve as a member of the servant caste, which is called the Mbati, are completely different. And in fact, one of the keys to the way Varan works is that as an Mbati, for example, you wouldn't want to achieve the kinds of things that a nobleman would achieve. Because goodness gracious, you would never want to be a nobleman. Why? They're so unhealthy and they don't learn the things that we learn. And so each caste not only has its own sort of area of influence and effect, but it has its own reasons to feel like it's the most important and that the members of other castes are not the same, first of all, but also we wouldn't want to be like them. And here are the reasons. I was looking for a way to talk about distinctions that happen in our society and some of those phenomena that we have, the way that we divide ourselves. And I just wanted to make sure that I could put that right up front in a way that would allow me to tackle some of our issues, our own issues. The beginning of the book has an epigraph that says, Varan is a place where humans have always lived on an alien world. It is also your home. And it is not at all related to Earth. People ask me this all the time. Did they come on ships? Like, that was why I put that in the book, because no, they didn't come here on ships. I have hypothesized a world on which human life exists completely independently of Earth or our universe.
Dang, I thought that was where you were going to go with that.
But at the same time, it is also your home. I want it to seem very familiar to people. And I want people to recognize the kinds of social things that happen in Varan as things that happen. And in fact, it's like an enormous filter, a big social filter, where if you can see this social phenomenon here on Earth, you should be able to find it somewhere in Varan. But because Varan is so different, you don't necessarily know where you're going to find it or what exact form it's going to take in that environment. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. It answered my question too, actually. So I was wondering, there's one point in the series where I think it's one of Taggart's children has a stuffed rabbit. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, is that rabbit a rabbit or is that rabbit an analog to a rabbit?
Oh, it's an analog to a rabbit.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I thought that might have been a clue.
So this is a really interesting question. And sometimes people will say, if you want your world to be alien, you really got to go alien and that kind of stuff. And it's okay. But in my view, the more, this is just a linguistic metric. Mm-hmm. The more unfamiliar terms you use, the more alienated your reader will feel. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I don't like to use a lot of invented words. It sounds ridiculous because there are a lot of invented words in the series. But at the same time, those are the ones that are necessary for you to understand the story. And if I get to a point where somebody has a ceramic rabbit or somebody has, I don't know, rabbits appear, and they're not really rabbits. Mm-hmm. That they're like the equivalent, rough equivalent of a rabbit.
Or it's not a hound.
Oh yeah, tunnel hound is definitely not a dog.
Yeah, and I would love to see a picture of a tunnel hound at some point. Are there pictures out there of tunnel hounds?
Me too.
Somebody draw a picture of a tunnel hound for me, please.
I had such fun with the tunnel hounds. And actually, they were really important because they're one of the only connections that you have in book one to the natural world.
Right.
Right. The sense that there is something outside of this rarefied human society within these sort of almost palace walls and a reminder that we're actually on an alien planet. Yeah, I see them as a combination, a cross between a black lab and a platypus.
I'm going to try to draw that
they
later.
They look a lot like a black lab, but they don't have any eyes.
They don't have eyes, right? Yep. So.
No, they have no eyes and they have a very soft, almost like the platypus's bill, which has these electro sensors in it, which allow them to hunt in murky water. And that's how they hunt their prey in total darkness.
And I can't get one of those. I can't have one.
No, sadly, I want one too.
I would love a tunnel hound, please. So listeners.
No, I love the tunnel hounds. And I, you know, when I first invented the tunnel hounds, I didn't realize that there were going to be tunnel hounds that were actually really important characters in the second book.
Yeah.
And when I got there and I realized I was going to have actual tunnel hounds, I was like, oh, this is, you know, yeah. Oh, that's a really interesting question. I wonder, yeah, okay. I may indeed have Tunnel House coming up. I hadn't thought about that yet.
Yeah, no, I love them. I want one of my
That's
own.
That's awesome.
That isn't clear. I kind of jumped.
I need to make sure that we have, someday we need plushy Tunnel House.
Yeah, that's exactly what I want. I have a plushy Cthulhu behind me. Same idea. Weird, but cuddly.
Oh, cuddly, for sure. Yeah.
Juliet, my understanding is with the original conception of the series, you would have started the events in book 3, but you recognized the need to tell how we got there. And as a reader, I'm thankful for that.
We all are.
Finally, Inheritors, though, we get to see the figurative and literal meanings of the title of the whole series. We've seen references to the Global Trust in the previous books, but Inheritors gives us an aha moment. Can you tell us a little bit about the Global Trust as we understand it at the beginning of Inheritors?
Yeah, the Global Trust is, I would say, the sort of ideological guiding force of the nobility. And the way that they see their role in society is as guardians of everyone else. And so they're the ones who have all the resources. So it's their job to hand them out to the people according to need. And according to need is a big concept within the Global Trust. Basically, to give to each group of people the resources that they need in order to do what they need to do effectively and safely, et cetera. Now, of course, resource allocation being what it is and nobility being what they are, the Global Trust is declined somewhat. Also, the Grobel themselves, the nobility, are the Grobel. They're in decline. Varan is in decline, basically. They're in decline technologically. They're in decline, in the Grobel's case, physically. And things are not going well for them. And they don't, to some extent, they don't understand why, but to some extent, they don't want to understand why. If the Grobel ever turned around and took a close look at why they're having the problems they're having, they would shy away from that because it would involve questions like, should you really be isolating yourself from the rest of the population? And is this decline worth it for the power that you hold? But the Global Trust itself is something that people see as having been handed down from the great founder, the great Grobel Finn. And it is their guiding principle, at least as we know it in the first two books and at the beginning of the third book. It also happens to be an actual document. No spoilers, but it's an actual document. You see it even in book. It appears in the background of the accession ball, because at the accession, members of each class have to go back to a table and sign it, give their people into the trust of the new eminence. So yeah, that document does appear as a document in all three of the books.
Yeah, we came a long way from book one. I was trying to remember. I took the whole journey in 2 weeks. Should be fresher in my mind, but yeah. And it was a great journey too, by the way. So you've clearly given a lot of thought to the setting's influence on the culture. You've got paper as a crop that's in short supply. So letter writing is an art form. At least that's my kind of takeaway from that. You have the Shinka trees, right? That they absorb energy and emit light and are actually used as a light source to some degree by the people. And then you've already touched a little bit on the wisps.
Yeah.
And they started, so if you can ignore them until they get agitated and they start to swarm, and then they basically level in and
yes,
they're super scary. But by the time we get to Inheritors, you've got wisp whisperers.
Yeah.
I should say wisp listeners is the proper term, but I like calling them wisp whisperers because of the alliteration. Yeah. So there's a mystery. I feel like there's a mystery in the ecosystem that hasn't been resolved.
Uh-huh.
Are you going to resolve it? Or is it going to remain? Actually, that's a total spoiler right there. I shouldn't even ask the question.
Wow.
Are we going to get more on that?
Let's just say that the big social bombshell hits in book 3, and the big ecological bombshell hits in book 4.
Awesome. And when's that coming?
I'm working on it. Thank you. I shall.
So you've written about your interest in caves while you're in France, and you actually descended 110 meters into a cave. Mm-hmm. Clearly, you've done a fair amount of research on them and modeled some of Varan's cities on actual sites. Can you tell us about how your fascination with things subterranean informs Broken Trust?
I have always been fascinated by the idea of the subterranean. I don't know why. I think it's just cool. Underground stuff it's so interesting to me. And the other thing that I've discovered about it over time is that it's so thematically interesting. Mm-hmm. Because what we're looking at is things that are there, but invisible. And so if you were standing on the surface of Varen, you might see the agricultural fields, but you wouldn't realize that there were these enormous cities. They were just sitting there under the ground. Varen is all about what we hide and what happens underneath the surface and what we don't see. So caves are, I think that grew, that idea, the thematic idea grew alongside the concept for the world, because it started out as just, wouldn't it be cool to have these underground cities, right? Because I was a little kid. But yeah, I mean, I went down, so my very first cave experience that I recall was at the Gouffre de Padirac, which is in France. And you go down about 100 meters into a sinkhole in an elevator. You can't actually walk downstairs, but you can go in an elevator. I think the last time we actually went down the stairs and came back up the elevator. Anyway, so you go down and then you walk for a while underneath the ground, and then you reach a dock and they put you on a boat. You ride along this underground river for 20 minutes or so. And all the while, you've got these massive rock formations around you. Like, you can see where the walls have been scoured by the river over time. You've got this point where they stop and they say, look up, here is the spot where it's 110 meters to the ceiling above your head. And I was like, what the heck? That's huge, right? You could fit a whole city in here.
And so you did.
And so I did. Seriously, it was fun because we actually had the good fortune to go back to the group just 4 years ago when my son was 12. And he was the same age that I was when I first discovered the same place. And it was just amazing to take him there and see him looking around and going, and to feel that wonder again in my heart and remember what it was like for me. It was really a formative experience for me. And I didn't realize it at the time. I remember being awed, of course, but I didn't realize until much later that was the point where Varen was actually conceived somewhere in my brain, because the books themselves and the world didn't really start to flower until I was in high school and later. Yeah, it's been a long and interesting process. And I could see, I'm fascinated by the social questions, right? And I really wanted to make sure that I had these ideas for these characters. Like, the characters in book three have been in my head since I was probably 16. And I knew some of the things that I wanted them to go through. But I really also, the older I got, the more I studied anthropology and linguistics, the more I wanted to understand the world that they were a part of. And that was where I really started to realize that I needed more books. Because if you don't understand Nicanor and how he thinks, then you're going to lose so much of what happens in Inheritors of Power. And if you don't understand things about wisps that you learn in book two, you're not going to understand the impact. I think I've segued here, but if you'll forgive me, one of the things that I learned over time about writing is that if you want something to hit really hard, you can do your best to put words on that spot. But really, the impact of that piece comes from what's come before it. It comes from the lead-in. It comes from the background information. It comes from the resonances that you create with everything that you have led up to that point with. And so my personal preference is to construct these things way in advance so that by the time you get to the spot where the big thing happens, you actually need a minimum of words.
Because they're already flooded with context, right? They're already rich.
Right,
with that.
And yeah. You don't want to put effort on a reader in the spot where you want them just to be able to sit back and go, whoa. You want them all to have done all of that effort in advance so that then when they get there, they can just be with the revelation and go, wow, and experience it differently and not have to do work.
On a related question, can you tell us how living in France and Japan helped shape the Broken Trust series as well? I'm assuming the caste culture had something to do with that in with Japan, but was there other aspects of living in France and Japan that helped shape the Broken Trust series?
So I have been very fortunate. My experiences in Japan and France have been, I wouldn't say unique, but they've been non-touristy. Because when we go to these places, we have friends. My friends in France are friends of the family. Because they were friends of my parents. And my friends in Japan are friends of mine because I went to a university program where I had a host family. But when you are hosted by a family in a foreign country and you can speak the language to some degree, it's a very different experience from just going to see the sites. And so I've always tried to engage deeply with the places that I, in fact, I find it very odd when I go to a place where I don't speak the language because then I'm like, oh, I have to figure out what's going on here. And my approach is always to try to learn some, but that just tells you how I approach things. But I think these experiences really deeply influenced my concepts of difference. It's really hard to understand how different ways of thinking can be until you've lived in an environment and grappled with the language that the people in the area use to interact with their environment. If that makes sense. I'm not going to say constant, but yeah, pretty much constant. And lots of little tiny observations that pile up. And I try to create that sensation in my work, right? Where there are just these little details of things that are different that you didn't even think could be different. It didn't even occur to you. Yeah, okay, we know things are going to be different there. But I like to single out the things that are so taken for granted that it never occurs to you that they could be different. And then you look at it and you say, but wait, how? Right. And so I try to get into that. Cultural judgment is a huge tool for me. And this is why I use close point of view. And it's all because of the judgment. Now, I suppose my travel experiences subjected me to people's judgment. That's for sure. I learned a lot about discrimination when I was in Japan, because I had never been a minority before. And that was eye-opening. And I could see a lot of things that I had not previously considered in that same way. I think all of it comes together, especially the experience of living in a place where your integration with it is so deep. Yeah. And I know that, for example, in Japan, I'm never going to achieve that. It's fine. That's just how it is. But at the same time, I can try to explore that idea in Varen. And one of the things about Varen is there are no foreigners, right? We are always in internal perspectives. But because of the caste system, everybody's perspective is different. And so as readers, we can observe the changes between, say, a noble perspective and a servant's perspective. And we can learn from that contrast, where in a way that each of the characters is limited and can't do unless they are connecting in a specific way with the other character. So I try to convey what's normal and what's not normal in these various ways, depending on which caste we're dealing with, and then allow the reader to see the contrast and see that there are phenomena that that exist, that they empirically exist in the societal context, but that nobody is really right. It's really important to remember that in Varen, nobody is right. Everybody has their own culturally grounded perspective on what's going on. And everybody is an unreliable narrator in one way or another. Mm-hmm. Because in some ways, I think we all are. We are all unreliable narrators of our experience because we can't see everything. We don't know everything.
And that's one of the things I really love about these books, the multiple perspectives. So you have no foreigners, but you do have others. And every other caste is. And
right.
So you
Everyone's other to everyone else.
Yeah. And so you provide us with the internal, in the first person narration, you're getting each of those other perspectives stacked up on each other. And really the reader's the only one who knows what's going on, ultimately. Yeah. So I listened to that world building session you did at ECC, and you and Jenny both touched on point of view, and in particular, the difficulties of advancing the plot when a character is idle. So you've got Akrobidi Corbinon. He's in the Hoosgow for most of the narrative, but his point of view is essential to the story, right? So he's a learned garbage collector, which I think is great, sanitation engineer, and he's a tales everyman, but he's constantly being acted upon, and he's not an actor in his own, and things get worse for him when his ability to communicate gets compromised. But that challenge leads to some of the most poignant writing in the book, where he and Akrobidi Midas develop a method of relating without speech. So can you talk a little bit about, first of all, about that plot and theme, the balance between them in your writing, and how each of them is advanced by writing from multiple viewpoints? And I got a follow-up.
Wow. So I always say that stories are like clock, and you can enter them at any point, but ideally everything should be interconnected. And so what... Theme is, I don't know, sometimes I find myself working deliberately on theme or symbolism or this kind of stuff. And sometimes I just don't. I think my entry point is usually character. And I've written Corbinon a lot of times, believe it or not. And I've tried, each time that I re-enter this piece, I try to understand him better and what motivates him and what... He wasn't always an everyman, believe it or not. But when he became one, that was when it clearly came together and became right. I think a lot of what this story is about, and it began very much at the beginning, because I always knew Carbonin was going to be trapped and imprisoned. I always knew that part. He was going to be trapped and imprisoned from the very beginning. And I think my understanding of why has changed, because it was a plot point. Yes, this man gets put in prison. But over time, I started to understand why he was put in prison. And he's been imprisoned in more than one way. His ability to communicate is, as you say, compromised. And I don't want to talk about how, but that is another kind of trap. You could say in some ways, Ivarin is all about traps. People who are trapped in cities, people who are trapped in social situations, people who are trapped literally in a prison or trying to escape from a town. So it's all about layers and layers of traps and the limitations that people come up against and how they try to transcend those. But I think everybody's trap is different. So that's where the point of view comes in. So with a world as big as Varn, it's really hard. And I know this because it took me years to figure out. It's really hard to contain it, to keep it from bubbling over and completely overwhelming what you're trying to do or trying to say. There's just so much information there that it's easy to have it. Back in the days when I was first starting, it was very easy to have it overwhelm the story. And at a certain point, I realized that the key to containing it was to contain it inside people. And that's when my interest in deep point of view really became a serious tool for storytelling. Because when you're in a very specific point of view, you only need to understand as much as that one person understands at any given point, which is great because the reader is one person. Mm-hmm. And so the reader will be able to keep going because they understand exactly what one person understands at that point. So it's a kind of another kind of containment, right? The size of the world is huge, as our world is huge. We don't understand our world. Our knowledge of what goes on in our world is very limited, because as much as we learn, there's always more. There's always somebody more than us in this topic or that topic, or wherever you find a place to go dig deeper, there is a deeper to dig to. And I wanted people to feel that when they read about Varn, the feeling that there is a whole world outside of this, is a whole world outside of these walls that we don't necessarily understand. I think some people have a hard time with that because it is hard to admit sometimes that we don't know everything. But yeah, so in the end, I think Carbonin is caught up in systems, mm-hmm. as well as in literal prison.
Yep.
And I really wanted to be very explicit about the systems that he's caught up in. Like, I sat myself down and I said, okay, rule number one for this book is that Carbonin is not going to experience the trials that he experiences because of malice from any particular person. He is just going to be caught up in system. And even Nicanor, who is acting on him explicitly, is not acting on him for any reason that relates to him. Nicanor is just doing to him what he would do to anybody who showed up and was a part of this particular narrative in Nicanor's mind. The fact that terrible injustice may not have anything to do with what you really meant to do or what anybody really meant to do is important.
No, it's right. You're right. He's sort of caught. He's caught, right? And it's in a stream.
He's not caught up in these things that are larger than he is, and they grind him up. And yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see where he goes from here. For me, as well as I hope for readers. Yeah.
I just wanted to point out that I think Zinta, Nicanor's embodied manservant, is one of the great compromised characters in science fiction. Yeah, I'm just going to lay that out there and then move on to the next question. I think he's great. And I love what you did with that character, because no one understands him except the reader.
Yeah.
No one understands him except the reader.
He doesn't even understand himself.
Yeah, I think he's great. But I wanted to ask you about Nicanor, and I have read some critiques of the character. At least one of them found fault in the fact that he, as the central antagonist, has OCD. And I had some real problems with the argument, because it suggests that you're attributing causality where there isn't any, right? And Nick isn't a villain because he has OCD. He's not really even villain, really, per se, but he's a villain with OCD. And that, my mind, that makes him more interesting as a character. His coping methods are fascinating. But there's a real suggestion that mental health is deeply misunderstood by Varin, right? By the whole society.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, definitely. And I go so far as to say, like, maybe his own people attribute the same misplaced causality that reader who made the critique does.
I think so.
Yeah, who really only has one.
First of all, he is an antagonist, but he's also a protagonist. And in book two, particularly, it was very difficult to keep him as a protagonist because he had to be behind the scenes. Otherwise, the book wasn't going to work. But I believe in him as a kind of protagonist. And he is the distillation of everything that is wrong with Varn. And his OCD is exactly the problem that Varn has. The obsession with keeping things in boxes and making sure that they are categorized and controlled. So he suffers as the society suffers. And he is a cause of suffering, but he always suffers at the same time. And I think the thing that makes him, he's a tragedy. Because
which you don't really get until this last book.
Like this. It shouldn't have had to be like this. He should have been able to get help. And that's one of the reasons why, and I don't want to get too spoilery with this, he is not the only person with OCD in the story.
Because I was just about to give that away.
I could talk about it. This is one of the reasons why Taggart's son has OCD.
And he's terrified that he has it because he thinks that there's a stigma associated with it that his parents are trying desperately to reassure him is misplaced. We've had some mental health issues in my family, but how much you have to say about that? About how mental health is misunderstood by our society.
I think so. And I also think that one of the things that's saddest about Nicanor is that he, at the same time that he would benefit from not having the views that he has or not being surrounded by this stigma and the power hungriness and everything else, he has embraced the need for that. And he is inherently tearing himself apart because he would reject anything that actually helps him.
And you can see that.
Because his society has taught him to do that.
Yeah, and you can see that in his relationship with Zinta, right? Because Zinta sees the tragedy firsthand.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Zinta is trying desperately to help him. And it's very difficult. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, enough said.
Yeah.
Thanks. I listened to your first book. I read the second too, but I listened to the first one. There's an audiobook. And I liked the voice work and I liked that there were different narrators representing the different characters. And then I went back and I noticed there's an audiobook for the second book, but there isn't one yet for the third book. Is there an audiobook in the works for that?
Not at this time. Okay. In a pandemic is a hard thing.
Yep.
So I am hoping that at some point we will have the opportunity to get audiobooks made for the remaining books of the Broken Prince. Mm-hmm. But for now, there aren't any.
Okay. I'm we'll a completist is all I like.
Oh, I know. And honestly, I love the audiobooks. The audiobooks were so amazing and the process of finding these amazing readers was so amazing that I am dying to have them for the rest of the series. But one thing at a time.
Fingers crossed.
Me too. Because I really want to hear somebody do Zinta. And Zinta has been basically my favorite character from the very beginning.
Yeah, he's definitely my favorite character.
He's gnarly and complicated.
Yeah, he's great. He's really great.
Yeah. Anyway, but here we are talking about him and not saying anything substantial.
The book.
I don't know. You got to just see it to believe it.
Now, jumping from audio to video, while we usually don't ask about casting here on the podcast, we have seen past interviews where you have talked about your enjoyment of dream casting. So why not? Why don't you tell us who your dream casting would be for leads for The Inheritors?
Oh, so I always, I love these questions, but I also agonize because I don't know that many actors. But like, I imagine David Tennant would be such an amazing adult Nicanor. I think he would really be able to capture the pathos of him and also the intensity, because Nicanor is an incredibly dense guy, an intense guy. It's much harder to cast the others. It really is.
But
yeah,
Zinta,
I don't know. It's.
I thought I saw you. But, I thought I saw that you had a Zinta picked out.
I keep trying on different Zintas because I found this one guy who I thought would be really interesting Zinta because he had played Ariel in The Tempest by Shakespeare. And I really see Zinta as an Ariel figure. And so I think that if you're a person who has understood Ariel, you might be able to do Zinta well. When we were looking for the audiobook narrator who read Aloran for book one, I kept feeling like he hadn't initially in the initial things that he hadn't quite captured the. So I love the man's voice, but I was like, no, I'm just not sure he's quite getting Aloran. And then I realized that it was actually about my communication that was lacking because Aloran kind of has two personas. And if you don't understand that about him, it doesn't work. He has his professional persona, which is very contained and very measured and professional sounding. And then he has his personal persona, who's actually very shy.
Mm-hmm.
Lauren is an extremely shy person, but his job doesn't allow him to be shy.
Mm-hmm.
So when I explained that to the audiobook narrator, Nishi, he really grasped that in a beautiful way. And all of a sudden it just clicked and it was amazing. And this is what a great actor do, but yeah. But yeah.
I thought there was a sort of gentleness to his voice. Yeah, there was a sort of a gentleness to his voice and a sort of soft-spokenness that I thought fit the character very well.
Yeah, yeah. No, he really captured both sides of, mm-hmm. of Lauren's character, which I deeply appreciated. And Brian Nishi, that's the same. We asked him back to read Adon in book two because that was really appropriate. Yeah. I'll just leave it at that. And he did a beautiful job. Jake, I encourage you to go and find the audiobook for book two because it was beautifully done. Absolutely beautiful. The woman who reads Malin is just incredible.
All right. Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Malin's going to be back for book four.
Oh, that's good.
And we're also going to have the same four from book three, but Malin will also.
I know there are characters from the first book. Like, I can't pronounce his name. Yaris. Yeah.
Yeah.
I liked him too. I'd love to see him again. But yeah,
we are going to see him again, but through Malin.
Gotcha. The same way you did with Tagrit and Della, right? Yeah, you did something similar where we get Della's point of view in book two.
Yeah. So one of the things that is important to me, at least, is the larger concept of Varin as the main character. Mm-hmm. Like the society is the main character, right? And so everybody has their different viewpoint on how the society works. And the more points of view we encounter, the more we learn about the society because of these limitations that each person has. And that's one of the reasons why it's really important not just to have the same characters all the way through the story, because the story is much larger than any one person.
And it is generational too.
It's generational, and there isn't just one hero. This is, in some respects, this is my ode to how we should not have the divine right of kings. So it's important to me that the perspectives keep changing, because I think it would be honestly inconsistent with the world itself if we didn't have these changes in perspective.
Uh-huh. If it was all Grobbles all the time.
We're used to all Grobble all the time.
We are here, yeah.
I think in the science fiction and fantasy, it's very common mm-hmm. to have all Grobble all the time. And that was why I started there, because I wanted to have a familiar entry point before I started tumbling things and reversing things and looking under the carpets and stuff like that. Sometimes literally.
Juliet, thanks for taking the time to talk extensively about the Broken Trust series. You're just really incredible to listen to from listening to you, and just makes me look at the series in a whole new way. And I can't wait for books four and five. Now that you're based in Australia, though, does that mean you won't be attending things like Emerald City Comic Con this summer?
I'm regrouping right now. Yeah. Honestly, there was a period when I just couldn't even write because it was moving. Mm-hmm. So I'm regrouping and I'm hoping that I can start coming back to do events in the US. Emerald City Comic Con is high on my list. It's hard when the world is constantly changing.
Yes.
So let's just say that is one of my main goals mm-hmm. is to be able to come back to the US for events, as I would like to be more binational than, but it's also, there's also COVID and everything else makes these things hard to predict.
We'd love to talk to you when book four comes out. And we certainly could call you at a time that's more reasonable for you as well. Because I didn't hear you say something about the morning and I was so confused.
This got arranged way before I moved and I was going to do it before I moved and I was great. And then everything snowballed and I was like, there's no way.
Yeah, I actually had some family members got COVID at that time. It was the worst. My son couldn't go to school and my wife could not go to work. And I was the only caretaker at that point.
Everybody's okay. I hope everybody's okay.
Yeah, I'm surprised I didn't get it. But again, wearing masks is... it's important. I'm double boosted as well. Again, thank you so much. I learned so much.
Yeah, thanks.
Again, when you saw at Emerald City Comic Con, I wanted so badly to interview you that day, but you just were too popular.
I'll be quite honest with you. I worked towards this for a really ridiculous amount of time. I started writing three for the first time in 1999. And didn't get published until 2020 with book one. Book one was sitting on the editor's desk for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Read it. And I believed in it and my agent believed in it so hard that we just sat and waited until she got around to looking at it. And honestly, that could have been a bad bet because, what if she didn't like it? But we were like, we really don't want to try to go small press with this. And that was how I ended up with Daw, was that Sheila Gilbert got around to reading it because she's got so much to do and so many people clamoring for her to read. That's the limiting point, right? Mm-hmm. You have to, if you're going to publish it, you have to read it. You can't,
ideally,
you can't just be like, computer, read it for me. Or like you have to, as an editor, you have to actually read the book.
I work for a university press and it's not always clear to me that's what's going on.
I think academic publishing is a little different, but yeah, I hear you. But yeah, no, so it was very long, and even longer because of how long it took me to develop the world and everything else.
Thanks, Juliet. Thank you so much.
Great talking to you.
Take care.